to iDeveloper Live, episode 26. Yeah, it was the day of the Lion. Lion has been installed on the machine I'm using here in the office, and of course, nothing works as far as audio is concerned. But never mind, we think we've just about got it. We are broadcasting live. If for people listening out there live on the iTunes feed, the iTunes audio stream, I think it sort of sounds like we're in the cubicle of some men's room somewhere. But actually, we're not. We're a good 4,000 or 5,000 miles apart, so there's nothing dodgy there at all, I assure you. Who am I talking about, of course? Now, I'd like to welcome to the show Mr. Kent Sutherland. How are you doing, Kent?
Good, thanks for having me.
That's great. It's great to have you here in the bathroom. Okay, Kent, tell us a little bit about yourself.
Okay, well, hopefully we can, you know, speak over the flushing randomly. I'm the co-founder of Flexibits, along with Michael Simmons. We do a develop a Mac program called Fantastical, which we're going to be talking about today, I'm assuming. In the past, some other stuff that I've worked on is Chex, which is an iChat edition that adds a bunch of features to iChat, which is also currently broken online, so that's another interesting set of problems, but that's about it.
Okay, well, we're sat here today about 24 hours after the release of OS 10.7 Lion. I installed it this morning. Everything has been great right up until now. Of course, audio stuff is renowned for maybe not keeping right on the edge of the technologies, but let's just ignore that for a moment. Are you a Lion user? And if you what's your favorite feature?
So overall, I guess upgrading has been pretty uneventful for me. I think the nicest thing since I spent a lot of time in iChat, I think, you know, the new stuff that they added there is nice because each revision I have to do less and less work for checks. So I'd say the improved iChat is my favorite thing, because it's the thing I notice the most right now.
Cool. That's cool. I mean, I think it's just generally one of these sort of polish releases to me. It's like everything feels slightly more polished. It's not that I can name any major feature. More about everything just feels a little slicker. I love the sort of slightly more, should we say, laid back look. Everything's slightly more muted in its colors. Of course, the reverse scrolling is something that lots of people will be getting used to for the first time today. And actually, for the first time in the entire process of Lion being available, because obviously developers have been able to get it for a while, the App Store install worked properly.
I haven't had to go through that process yet. But I'm still using the GM build.
All right. Okay. So you're using the super secret build. I did hear some people on Twitter sort of slightly claiming that the GM build was it's a different build number, but we're probably not allowed to talk about that, so we won't go there anyway.
I'm pretty sure they got retracted afterwards.
Did it? Okay. Well, I don't. I was sort of only half following. Okay. So now, Fantastical. We spent quite a lot of time on episode 25 talking with your business partner Michael Simmons,
right,
about what Fantastical is, and some of the reasons that it was developed, and some of the theory behind it. So I guess we don't necessarily need to repeat that, and we know its ethos. But the thing that very very first struck me about Fantastical when I first saw an early beta was the way you just entered dates, or events, because it's not just dates, the natural language processing. Was that something that was designed, you thought was going to be at the core of Fantastical right from the very beginning, or was that something you thought of as you were going along that, hey, this would be cool?
No, I mean, it was definitely at the core the whole time. We actually built the entire product around the idea that of having this feature in the first place. So, I mean, when we first started development, we had we had a working prototype of just the natural language processing, and we thought, you know, what do we need to add to it to turn this into something that's actually usable every day?
Okay, so you sat down and said, we want to design this thing and we want to do it around natural language processing. Had you done any natural language processing at that point? Had you been prototyping, looking into this stuff, trying to work out how you could do it, realizing that, hey, this stuff's quite cool and we can do this, let's build around it? Or was it, hey, this is a good idea, let's go for it?
So maybe about 5 or 6 months before we even started working on it, I was still in school and I was doing a project for a machine learning course, and the course was structured learning, which is taking a set of data and outputting a prediction that has a certain sort of structure to it. And so my project was parsing sentences and turning those into events. And it worked well enough that I figured, you know, we could spend some more time on it and potentially turn it into something that people would actually use. And, you know, about this time next year, here we are.
Okay, so it started as a school project. That's cool.
It did.
So, I mean, maybe if we can take a sort of a step back and, you know, maybe do a bit of a computer science lecture, like we're all in school again. You know, when you're approaching something like this, where you need to be, you know, obviously you're looking to parse natural language and turn it into a define something that has to be defined. It's this echo in my head. I can hear myself slightly behind, like I'm in the bathroom. You know, what are the things that you have to consider? You know, what are the principles, you know, the first principles of parsing something into something else?
Okay, well, I'm by no means an expert on this or anything, but there's really kind of two different approaches you can take. One is approaching it from a language point of view. You know, you have grammars and parts of speech, and putting together a grammar or tagging so that you can then extract some sort of meaning out of the order of the words. Another approach you can take is just a straight data-driven approach, which is, you know, you look at each individual word and the characteristics of it, like, you know, how long is the word, or is it a number, or is it, you know, is it next to a number, something like that, and not even really worry about the grammar of what's going on and try to extract meaning from that. And that's more the approach that we take right now.
Right. Okay. So you're looking for keywords and then trying to establish that, you know, something to do with what they are, as opposed, because I mean, if you're writing a computer language, a programming language, I mean, you can set a very, very defined syntax that everyone has to follow, and right. You know, that's fine. Whereas yeah, if you're trying to do natural language parsing,
yeah, unfortunately, I mean, yeah. It's, you know, it's much less rigid. You can't compile someone's sentence.
So that's why you maybe approach just finding out random words. So. What techniques did you begin to use to sort of say, okay, well, you know, this type of word is going to be this type of word is going to be that? Do you start building up dictionaries of interesting words? Are you, you know, how are you identifying that a word might mean something within that sentence?
Well, so actually we don't need to actually look at individual words and have a dictionary. We can do that with some words where you think, you know, you know what tomorrow is, so you can identify tomorrow. But other words that'll show up in an event are meaningless for most things. So if you have an event such as, you know, going to the playground tomorrow, playground doesn't mean anything. So all you can do with that is you can look around it and see that there's tomorrow, or that, you know, based on sentences you've seen in the past, tomorrow usually comes after what you would want the title to be. And so you can build up those sort of relationships without ever trying to actually parse a grammar of what's going on.
So the reason that in Fantastic Hell, if I wrote those words, going to the playground tomorrow, that the, you know, the date will be set for tomorrow is what you've just said, but the location will be set as playground. Is that being triggered by the to the, as opposed to the word playground? It has absolutely no sense of playground at all.
Right. So the way this works is that you train the system on a set of example sentences that people create. So, you know, if someone says, you know, go to the playground, I want the playground to be the location, you then manually go in and tag each part of the sentence to be what you want it to be. And then later on, you hope that when someone comes along with a new sentence, which is, you know, going to the beach, it'll recognize it in the same sort of fashion. And then from there, get it correct.
Right. Okay. Now Michael was telling us last week, or last episode, because it was 2 weeks ago now, that the engine is something that learns. Now, it doesn't learn live within the software as it goes along, but I mean, you can train it. So is this the sense that you're just getting more and more phrases and you're tagging them in this way to teach it? Is that what he means by training it?
Correct. So, you know, you start out with this huge work body of data, and you tag each piece of it, and the hope is that this set of data becomes representative of the entire universe of possible sentences. So you make that set larger and larger, and then you hope that the probability of it covering anything that someone will enter will be high.
So this is why you were during the beta phase and the alpha phase of the software asking people if it could send back data, because you wanted to know the type of things that people were typing in and have a realistic data set as opposed to just what you thought people would do.
Correct.
Okay, so I'm assuming it only recognizes English at the moment, or is it multiple language?
So right now it's only English. That's what we're going for next is looking at expanding to other languages now that we have English working.
Okay. So, I mean, I'm just sort of jumping around a little bit here as I think of things, really, and I'll maybe ask you to drive us in just a moment, because you maybe do it in a far lot more logical order. I mean, you said that you train it through, you use the word huge. I mean, what sort of number of samples were you feeding this thing by the end, you know, for the sort of thing that went out the door at the end?
So we started out with maybe a few hundred samples, and now we probably tripled or quadrupled it. We'd like to make it even larger as we go, but I'd say we're well over 1,000. I don't know what the exact number is past that.
Carry on.
Oh, I was going to say, in an ideal world, we'd have even more than that, you know, tens or hundreds of thousands, but that's a lot of data.
Yeah, that's an awful lot of data. Okay, so you're feeding all of these sentences through to it, and it's not just a raw English. You say you've tagged them or marked them somehow to say that this is location, this is time, blah, 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 blah. You know, what is the engine? I'm going to call it the engine. I don't know what you call it. You know, what is the engine doing with that? How is it taking that data and, you know, using it in order that it might interpret things properly later on? I mean, if it's not just storing all these words, is it storing all these words so it might recognize them? Is it trying to recognize patterns? Is it trying to sort of do association? You know, what is the engine doing to learn?
Right. So what happens with all those samples is you try to recognize a pattern of what's going on. So, you know, one sentence might be, you know, going to the park tomorrow, and one might be tomorrow going to the park. And you want to be able to recognize that, you know, these are two different patterns, and you can distinguish between the two and still get it right. So the end product of what actually happens is you run this algorithm on it where you train it, and so this algorithm runs on my machine and sits there and cranks for a while on all of these sentences. And what it spits out in the end is a set of numbers. And these numbers then go into the final shipping product, and you can just multiply the numbers out, and you'll get a new you'll get a prediction of what the engine thinks is going on. So someone just asked a question about larger databases. All of this happens, locally at development time when the product is being built, and when it gets shipped out, it doesn't matter whether you have one sentence, 10 sentences, a million sentences being trained on. The end user sees the same thing. It's the same speed.
Right, because the training isn't about having a volume behind it. It's about having a set of stuff it's learnt.
Right. You want volume so that you capture the nuances of all the potential things. But once it gets trained, you get a set of numbers in the end, which work as well or as poorly as your algorithm is, and the set of features that you choose. And what features are is it's a term in machine learning. It's the information you extract from whatever you're trying to learn from. So, for example, if you have the word tomorrow, a feature might be, it's all letters, or it's how many letters long it is, or that the word is tomorrow, so that it thinks it might be a date. And you can combine all of these features into a combination of multiple features when you look at the different words. And what that'll do is it'll give you a prediction in the end.
Okay, I mean, I guess with date handling, there's a finite number of things you can do. I mean, you could say next week, next year, next month, 2 weeks' time, but I'm guessing, even though I could sit here for probably quite a long time and go through stuff, compared to just sort of trying to recognize natural language for anything, at least with dates, you've got probably a reasonable set of borders to work with.
Right. Dates are still surprisingly complicated, but it's still also it's a finite set for the most part, so it makes life a lot easier.
I mean, so how different did the engine end up on the release of Fantastical from that point when you were playing it as a school project? I mean, was the essence of it still pretty much the same, or were you learning as you went along and it ended up as quite a different thing?
It's in spirit, it's really the same thing lurking underneath. Obviously a lot more work went into it in terms of refinement and how it works, but the underlying theory and the general idea behind it remain the same all the way through.
Okay, so I mean, what research, when you were doing the school project, so what research were you doing to sort of work out how to do this? What were you reading? What were you looking at? Where were you getting your influences and in your sort of inspiration from?
Right. So the particular stuff I was working on was structured learning, as I'd mentioned before. So in machine learning, there's a whole lot of different subfields in terms of what you can learn. The most popular thing to do is learn, a binary relationship. You feed it a picture of a face, and you want to say, is this a face or is this not a face? And so from that, there's a whole class of machine learning techniques, support vector machines, just simple regressions, neural networks, all kinds of things like that. From there, you can try to move up to more complicated things, or outputting a structure of things. So you could say, given this protein, what would I predict that the protein would be? Say you have a protein that's missing pieces of it. You could try to predict, what was missing in it, or something like that. And so you can work your way and build up more and more complex things that you can predict. And so a lot of that research, I took that stuff in and kind of transformed it into keeping the same structure, but using it as using it to predict sentences instead of, faces or proteins or something like that.
So when you were setting out on this, were you already in Objective-C? I mean, I'm assuming this is written in Objective-C, the parser.
It's kind of a hybrid. It's C++ and Objective-C.
Right, okay. I'm assuming you were already experienced with at least one of those two languages.
Yeah, I've been doing Objective-C for a long time and pretty proficient with C++ as well.
Okay, so why the hybrid mix? Was there a limitation in one or other of the languages that meant you had to go one way or the other for different bits?
So originally, when I was working on this just as a prototype stage, everything was in Python, actually. Once we decided, you know, we want to actually turn this into something that we can ship, I kind of started pulling out all of the Python bits and replacing them with C++. And the logic behind C++ was that it's semi-portable. So, you know, if we did want to use it on a different platform or on the web or anything like that, I didn't really know where we were going immediately. So I built it with that and then wrapped that in Objective-C. So that made things potentially more future-proof.
Okay, so it's implemented as a library with an Objective-C wrapper, or are you using it as using the ability of Xcode to compile C++ and C and Objective-C all together at once?
Yeah, so it's pretty much a separate C++ library, and then there's just a couple of Objective-C classes that'll bridge it over to Objective-C. So on the Objective-C side, you can send in just a normal NS string, and you'll get back an NS dictionary of, I think, you know, this part is the date, this part is the time, this part is, you know, the title and stuff like that. But internally, it's all C++.
So do you think if, as someone who's using both languages and obviously now a year into this and down the line, probably pretty proficient in both languages, even if you weren't before, do you think that if you hadn't been looking for the portability and you just developed it in Objective-C, would it have been incredibly similar in the way it was internally working? Or do you think you'd have maybe done some things differently because Objective-C would have brought you something else to the table?
I think you would have ended up with something pretty similar. I mean, most of what was going on was under the hood, on the C++ side, was just, you know, running algorithms that multiply a bunch of numbers together and add those up, or would parse a string and spit out a number based on whatever the string was. And so some of that is clumsier to do in C++, but overall it would have been very, very similar.
So what would you say was the biggest challenge of the whole thing?
That's an easy one. The biggest challenge for most any sort of learning problem is getting enough data in the first place. And that was pretty much our biggest thing throughout the entire project, because what would happen is we'd have a certain set of sentences that we're working on, and we'd say, you know, we want these to work very, very well. And then when you send out a beta, someone else will come up with, you know, oh, I type my sentences in, you know, what's in some way that seems, you know, backwards to us, which is perfectly logical and grammatically correct, but it's something that we had never seen before and the engine had never seen before. So what we'd have to do then is feed those back in and keep iterating like that. And so that was definitely the hardest part of making this all work.
Okay, I mean, we obviously started this by writing a whole bunch of statements yourself. I mean, I guess it was at the alpha phase when people started using it, you began to see the other data. You know, on the whole, do you think you got, you know, a lot of that data right? Or was it actually you were realizing, you know, a huge number of people were using it differently and typing differently to what you'd thought?
Yes and no. So I think it was it was more of an education problem more than a usage problem. Some people would come in and sit down and try to dictate to it as if it were a secretary. And so they would say, you know, I would like to do this at this time or something like that. Whereas we were expecting it to be more like, you know, this at this time, more declarative. And so that was the initial thing that some people got confused on. But once we got over that, for the most part, people understood how to use it. And then what we could do is they would start using it, you know, in that sort of mindset. And then we could go through and then iteratively improve it based on that feedback.
Okay, that's so you're saying data was the challenge. Okay, so as a programmer, as the code writer, what was the biggest, the most difficult thing coding wise? I mean, I guess it's quite hard to break down because you're just sort of very focused on a single problem, I guess, or a single problem domain anyway. So, but you know, programming wise, you know, was the big issue performance, or was it I don't know. I'm saying performance and seeing if there's anything else.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I spent a little bit of time on performance initially, but that turned out to be completely, you know, a complete non-problem in the end. I'd say the biggest problem going forward, once, you know, the entire system was working, was more just the standard software engineering problem of what are we building in the first place, and how do you build something, you know, flexible enough that we can rip it apart, put it back together, and, you know, rapidly try different ideas, try different, you know, user interface things. Because, I mean, in the end, we spent the last 4 or 5 months more focused on interface more than the actual functionality of the program.
Right, so you spend a long time, you feel the core and making it work, and once you could make it learn, that was sort of going, and the rest was, because you developed the interface as well as the engine, yes?
Right, but I'm with Michael and I both did the interface.
Okay. I mean, Graham Lee is basically saying, so this is effectively an expert system. Would you agree with that, or would you argue with that?
It's not an expert system. Expert systems are more, in terms of artificial intelligence, they're more of an AI kind of idea. Machine learning is more. So with an expert system, what you kind of try to do is you try to build these trees of, you know, 20 questions kind of thing. This doesn't work like that. It's more of a numerical approach, probability based kind of thing.
Right. Okay. Yep. That fits with my computer science lessons anyway. and that's all I care, because I'm the only one who can actually talk to you at the moment. is this? You say performance isn't an issue, so going forward, there's a possibility you could start running this on mobile devices and things like that as well?
Oh, definitely. I mean, so the big performance problem is on my side, is on training it. Is, you know, I want a quad or eight core system to train it quickly. But, you know, once it's trained, you just have a set of a few thousand numbers. You just have to multiply them out a lot. And, you know, you want to make sure that doesn't go crazy, but for the most part, it's almost instantaneous on the client. So there's no reason that it wouldn't be doable on a mobile device.
Okay. I mean, do you ever see it going forward in doing voice recognition that turns it into words that then goes into the engine, or is that maybe a step too far?
It's something we've definitely talked about, and it's a nice idea. In terms of implementing it so that it works well, it's a bit of a problem, because right now what the engine assumes is that it's going to get a pretty accurate reading of whatever the user intended, at least in terms of spelling or close to being spelled correct. If you have voice recognition, what happens if a critical word turns from Monday into, you know, I don't know what sounds like Monday, so, but, you know, if a critical
Sunday.
Date, well, okay, Sunday or Monday, but I mean, if it turns into something that's not even a date anymore, you know, the entire system breaks down then. And so that creates a whole new set of challenges.
Oh, good question from Uli Kostura. Any worst case failure anecdotes?
Oh, I'd say the trivial way of worst case failure was, you know, you're testing this thing and you're copy and pasting sentences and you paste in a few hundred lines of code by accident or something. It doesn't get too happy when you do that. That was sort of the performance testing thing, is what happens if someone does go and paste in a Word document or something like that. Some other worst case failure things are if you want to try to trick the thing, what you can do is you can use your knowledge of a higher level language and say, you know, you recognize that this thing is looking out for words such as on or at or the. And you can chain those up into phrases that use on or at or the, and you can get some interesting results sometimes. But other than that, generally the sentences are short enough that the system doesn't break down too badly.
Okay, I mean, and I think it's a little bit counterproductive to buy a tool and then try and break it. So hopefully most people aren't doing that. You've sort of touched on this a little bit already, but you know, in the context of the development life cycle for Fantastical, what sort of percentage of time, I mean, the whole thing is dependent on this engine. I mean, that's the core feature. So how much of the time would you say went into getting that bit right? And then how much into sort of, you know, the user interface and having to display calendars and all the rest of the stuff that sort of probably most people just take for granted because it's a calendar app.
Right. So a lot of the work in terms of the learning in the engine was kind of front-loaded before we even got to deciding that we were going to turn this into anything. So, you know, I had 3 or 4 months of extra time there that it was at least working as a prototype. I'd say it's probably 40% of my time was spent iteratively going through and making it better. But It wasn't easy, but it was more, you know, you know what you need to do now. And so you could go through and you get an email from someone says it broken this way or I don't like it doing this. Or we'd go through a data collection tool, which we built into the alphas, which kind of automatically just looked at what people were doing. And you would just kind of see what's going on and see if stuff is breaking and you could fix it. But the real huge hurdles in terms of making the engine work were kind of jumped over early on, and then the, you know, the last maybe 50%, 60% was then actually making it into something that looks nice, works nice, feels correct. Because you could have what it was when it was a prototype, where you type in a sentence in the command line and it spits out a tokenized version, but that's not much good to anyone who wants to actually use it.
Okay, do you like working on UI, or do you much prefer the sort of mathematical sort of coding of the engine, or you like a bit of variety?
It's fun to be able to jump in between the two, because you can go and dig down into some research paper or something and tinker with the numbers, and then when you get sick of it, you can turn around and hop into Interface Builder or whatever, you know, Xcode's Interface Builder now, and do something completely different. So I enjoy doing both of them.
Okay, that's really good. So if you were starting this again, what would you change?
In terms of the engine, I don't know that I would I'd change a whole lot. I think I would try to get even more data. You know, we did a pretty good job of data collection, but I'd try to get even more. I'd probably try to think ahead of time a little more of handling different languages. That was something that was sort of in the back of our heads, but we wanted to just make it work. So we were kind of focused on just English. So that, I guess those would be the two kind of two things that I would have done differently.
Okay, Uli's asking the chat room again, were you the only coder? yeah, that's my telephone, by the way, chat room running away. I forgot to turn it off again. My understanding was, I think we covered this, that you coded the engine and then yourself and Michael did the interface. Is that right?
Correct.
Yeah, and we're talking, did we say about a year for the whole project?
Yeah, about 10 months, maybe.
So that's a lot of work, isn't it, for you know... I mean, I love the app. I use it a lot, but you know, some people, you know, will see it. Well, it's a little utility that they just throw stuff into.
Right.
I mean, to make that decision to spend a year for a couple of you doing that is quite a commitment.
Yeah, it definitely was. It was interesting to see it come together too, because there was a lot of staring at the same thing for months on end, because everything was kind of under the covers changing, and then. You know, maybe January, February rolled around, and all of a sudden, you know, it turns into this real application rather than just a little demo project.
So, what next for the engine? Or what next for Fantastico?
Right. So, as I mentioned before, you know, handling other languages is a huge priority. So that, you know, everyone can use it. Past that, in terms of the engine, it's more just making sure that it meets expectations. It, I think for the most part, it does better than I was hoping that it would do. The number one worry that I had when we shipped it out is, you know, we went from, you know, 100 people or so using it, and for the most part, they said, you know, it worked great. But that's a completely different world than anyone in the world going and downloading it and saying, you know, oh, well, this broke or this broke. And very little of that happened, which I'm very happy to say. So, you know, past languages, it's going to be more just iteration on in that. For the rest of the application, it's more going to be, now that we've released it, everyone says, you know, oh, it's this calendar. So I expect it to work like iCal. Whereas when we originally developed, we thought, oh, it'll be this great, you know, companion application to iCal. And so now there's this huge, huge chasm between those two things that we now have to figure out how we're gonna span it. So stuff like, you know, editing events, deleting events, being able to manage your alarms, having you know, a full account management and stuff like that is something that we'd thought about it, but we figured, oh, this is unimportant. And now that stuff is important.
Right, so there's a refocus, because, I mean, I guess initially you saw it as something that sat on top of iCal, and I think it sits on top of BusyCal as well, doesn't it? I guess, understandably, because people are seeing this as their interface to their calendar, they want it to do everything that they want
right.
their calendar to do. And I guess you've got to make a choice. Are you going to stick with your guns and say, no, we are a utility on top, or are you going to effectively begin to develop a full-blown calendar app that happens to have language recognition as a major feature?
Right, and that's something that we haven't figured out entirely. Like we know we want to do some things, but now it's going to be a tough choice of picking and choosing what we want the application to do and what people want to do, and kind of merging those two expectations.
When you approach the engine in another language, are you going to, obviously you need to train it in another language, and you need that data so you can mark it up again, and I guess it will just break down to a set of numbers like it does now. But are you going to sort of try and make one engine learn to recognize a language and therefore work out the numbers in the right way? Or do you think you'll have, you know, an English version of the engine, a Spanish version of the engine, an Italian version of the engine, so it only ever has to deal with the sort of the math for the language it's working with, as opposed to just trying to work out the languages as well?
Right. I'm not sure yet. I think what's going to happen is going to be the latter. It's going to be more, you know, here's the here's the English mode of it, here's the Italian mode of it, and we'll keep the core of them will all be the same. Obviously, they'll be trained on large sets of the same sort of data, and with the same sort of features going into it, but it'll be slight variations based on whatever the language, you know, the vocabulary and the grammar of each particular language.
So in theory, the current engine now should be able to deal with, let's pick Italian, if you could get a big enough set of Italian data and mark it up and just feed it into the current engine.
Right, so in theory that would work, you know, and you'd be able to, instead of recognizing tomorrow, you'd recognize, you know, whatever tomorrow is in Italian.
I have no idea.
And so that's the easy part in theory. The tricky part is when you run into, you know, whether different languages have different verb tenses or different you know, declarative versions of nouns, compound words, stuff like that. You know, English doesn't have any of that sort of stuff. And so that could get more complicated depending on the language you're trying to go into. I mean, something like Chinese or Japanese would be an absolute nightmare because I know nothing about either of those languages, and you know they're not even Roman characters either. So I wouldn't have the slightest idea how to approach that. And so that's something that, you know, that might never happen, but we don't know yet.
So do you feel your future is far less to do with becoming a better engineer and more to do with becoming a linguistics expert?
I hope it doesn't come down to that. I mean, I'll certainly have to learn a little bit just to get things together, but we're hoping that we'll get some people that are at least fluent in the languages that'll keep us from making huge blunders.
Okay, that's... Yeah, that's cool. I mean, you said earlier on that you know, when you're training the engine, you'd love to have an 8-core Mac Pro or whatever. I mean, you know, throwing these 1,000 or a couple of 1,000 or whatever it was sort of samples at it. I mean, you know, what sort of time are we talking for it to learn? Is it, you know, is it still just a few minutes and you're being impatient, or is it literally sat there for hours trying to process this stuff?
On what I spent most of my time developing on was a Core 2 MacBook Pro. So on that, I'd run it overnight. It was easier. I didn't have to worry about it. I just, you know, put the thing in a different room so the fan spun up and then go to sleep. I'm running on a quad core MacBook Pro now, and that's made life quite a bit better because you can run things so much faster. So, you know, what was a 6-hour thing before turned into a couple hour run. And what that does is lets you iterate throughout the day, which makes the accuracy in your life much, much better.
Yeah, because you can throw some samples at it and see what it does, do it again. You can do that several times a day, more productive, I guess.
Right, instead of getting one in the morning and one at night. And if you forget one, then there goes your day, at least in terms of that particular task.
So the engine training, at least, if nothing else, is multi-threaded. It can cope with being thrown lots of different things at the same time. Is that why the multiple cores has helped, or is it just the fact you've got a faster processor now?
It's not multi-threaded. What happens is that I'll run multiple instances of training different variations, and so I'll have to run, you know, 16 or 20 of those, and so you can just spin up a separate process for each one and let it go.
So it's, all right, it's, okay. So, yeah, it's definitely, so why would you split it down that way? Is it just so it could process it faster, or is it that you've got a reason to divide the data up or look at different bits?
There's two reasons for it. One is when you want to test to see how well you're doing, you have to do what's called cross validation. So what that is, you know, you have 100% of your data, and if you want to see how well you're doing in terms of accuracy, you'll take a piece of that data and train the system on it. And then you'll take the remaining piece of the data and test on it. because what you don't want to do is you don't want to feed in, you know, 2 + 2 = 2 and then ask it what 2 + 2 is, because that's a trivial test. What you want to do is you want to teach it the rules of whatever you're doing and then give it a new set of problems and say, you know, okay, how do you do on this? So what that does is you train on 80% of your data and then test on 20% of your data, and you cycle that around, so you have 5 different tests. So, you know, instead of having to train it one time, you have to train it 6 times, because you have to train your 5 tests and then your full data set. And then you have to multiply that by a certain number, because we create different models based on what the user's entering. So you end up with 5 + 1 times, you know, 4 or 5. So it becomes quite a few different independent sets of training.
Right, okay, that makes sense now. Okay, so other than the engine, which we've spoken about quite a lot, well, in fact, before I move on to the UI, just a minute, you know, anything else about the challenge of the engine or something in there that you think our listeners will be interested in, or have we sort of done a fairly good coverage?
I mean, there are a lot of specifics, obviously, that I glossed over. There's just such a huge body of research that even I don't understand the math to. So, I don't know. I don't really have anything else in particular, I guess.
Okay.
But, I mean, have any questions, then I'd be happy to try to answer those.
So if you have questions in the chat room about the engine,
I don't want to pretend that I'm some sort of, you know, machine learning PhD here, but I've kind of gotten my hands dirty a little bit.
Hey, you've released a product that works on it. That's impressive in its own right. So, hey, yeah. Okay, so we've talked about the engine. While we're waiting for questions, if any come in, what was the biggest challenge on outside of the engine on the product? You know, what was the biggest challenge you had to face, you know, to do with the UI or any other part of it?
Right. So the two things, first was scope, as we mentioned before, was, you know, what is the role of this product? And we ended up going with a pretty narrow focus just to make sure that we actually finished it and got it out the door. Other than that, I think our biggest problem was UI. We spent a lot of time on the interface, you know, in terms of overall, you know, program flow to down to just the artwork and the details of what it looks like. And we probably went through maybe 4 or 5 independent sets of revisions where we take the UI and just build it up and then throw it out and figure, you know, this isn't what we were looking for, but we didn't know that until we were done. So that was definitely the most time consuming part of the project.
So, I mean, are you a... Do you have sort of a good eye for design? Were you? I know Michael is, you know, loves UI design and user experience, and you know that's probably where he would say that in the marketing was his strong points. Are you good at that side as well, or were you more okay? He's come up with something else, and I've got to code it.
There was a lot of that. I'd say he's definitely much more into the details than I am. I'm willing to gloss over things for better or worse sometimes. We were both really big on the overall program flow of, you know, what's the overall layout, what's going on in terms of that. He was much more adamant about particular little details, like, you know, I want a certain gradient here, or I want iPhone-like scroll section headers or something like that. That kind of stuff to me, but by the time I spend so much time actually implementing it, it's hard to step away and look at it. And so it's really good to have him there to pull apart the details.
I mean, that's a pretty good commitment to wanting to do it right, to say that, you know, we chucked it away several times because we just didn't like the end result. I mean, a lot of people would say, okay, this is good enough for version 1, we'll rehash for version 2. So, I mean, there was a serious commitment to not just producing something good, but producing exactly what you wanted.
Right. Well, part of the problem was that we couldn't produce what we wanted because we didn't really know what we wanted until we saw it, which was part of the trouble. So, you know, we'd go through and implement a whole new interface and say, it seemed like a good idea, but not quite.
So did you use external designers as well, or was this all in-house?
Combination of both. The original designs we did were kind of just thrown together to try to get the program flow going. And then we started bringing on other people to help us out with it, especially for just... Once we knew the overall structure of what we wanted, you know, we wanted animations here, we wanted a list of events here, we wanted the calendar to do this, this, and this, we could say, okay, this is the layout we want, this is how we want the experience to be, you know, how someone will actually use the program. Now we need to, it's not just throw a bucket of paint on it, it's more than that, but it's somewhere in between, you know, making it look pretty and the entire interaction of it. But once we had the interactions down for sure, we brought other people on to help make sure that it looked, you know, perfect and pixel perfect.
So Michael was sharing last time I was on that, I mean, obviously a year is a long time to commit to a product that you really have no idea if it's going to do well or not. I mean, I think it's great that it is doing well and well-deserved. And he said that as a company, you had to take on some client work as well to sort of pay a few of the bills and, you know, keep food on the table. You know, was that, you know, very distracting? How did you find that really broke up the flow for you, having to maybe concentrate on this and then that? Or is that... was it quite good to actually be able to go and focus on something else for a while and then come back?
Right. I think the way we did it worked out pretty well. What we had to do, though, was really limit ourselves to what we took on. You know, we took on one decent sized project and said, you know, that's it. We have to work on this as well, because it's easy to get tempted once you start doing contracts is to take on another, you know, another and another, because the leads start coming in and you have to you know, make a commitment to say, you know, we don't need those, we'll take the money on this one and make sure that that's enough to just, you know, make us get by till we finish this thing and actually finish it, rather than saying, oh well, we can take the money now from another contract, rather than having to go more for the unknown of your own program.
Okay, I mean, what, I mean, were you splitting yourself roughly 50-50 or 30-60?
It depended day to day. I'd say it was more 60-40, 70-30 favoring Fantastico.
Yeah, see, I said 60-30 because I never put 100% into anything. That was my excuse for that. Okay, question here on the integration. On the chat room, it's been said that people understand that the app integrates with iCal, Outlook, Entourage, I think BusyCal. So is the app developed with a whole bunch of layers and it just talks down depending on what you set it up to? Or are we misunderstanding the app altogether?
No, that's it. I mean, we built it with multiple different applications in mind. So, you know, we talk to iCal using a combination of the system's built-in calendar store framework, which can directly access iCal's database, and then we added some additional CalDev support on top of that. For Outlook and Entourage, we had to use AppleScript, because that's the only way that you can get into Outlook or Entourage's database. And, you know, that wasn't an ideal solution for us, because that requires Outlook or Entourage to be open. But it was better than nothing, and for the most part, everyone keeps Outlook and Entourage all day for people who use them. So it worked out pretty well.
Okay, that's... So did you sort of write a whole bunch of different libraries to interact with the different things so that internally you just make one set of calls and let the library sort it out? Or do you have a code bunch of, full of a bunch of if statements? Or, how did you structure that?
Right. So once we realized, we need this to work with a minimum of at least iCal, Outlook, and Entourage, if we just created a base interface of, so all of these applications do common things. You need to add an event to it. You need to be able to open it and show an event in the program. And you need to be able to fetch events with this particular date range from them. And so once we had that common interface between them all, we could just go down and, make separate classes and subclasses of each of those different program interfaces, and then just swap them in and out of the program and say, create your own API basically, and then use that everywhere in the application. And then when you actually need to do something, you can have it nice and separated from the rest of the application.
Makes sense. Makes a lot of sense. Okay. I think it's probably time for us just to begin to wrap up. We've been on there for a while. But maybe I've not spoken about something in the app that, you want everyone to know because you were really clever to make it work, or you just love speaking about it or whatever. So is there any other part of it you want to, do a bit of a, developer macho-ness on? Or even failing that, just something that caused you a complete pain in the backside and you'd like to warn people about?
I would say, pain in the back. the part I had the most fun about was combining the two different kind of worlds, the computer science and the software engineering / product development side. And I see a lot of apps that come out that they're great apps. I don't mean to insinuate anything, but it's just kind of, for me personally, it's take the data and put it somewhere, fetch the data and show it in this way. And I had a lot of fun doing something that was kind of different, taking something more theoretical and putting it together and making it into something that someone can use. And that's what I was going for with this project, in addition to just making something cool, was make something cool that isn't just putting together another application.
Yeah, I totally agree. A lot of apps, as you said, they just take something, save it, display it, and people put a lot of work in making that work well.
I don't mean to disparage that in any way at all.
But this had that sort of fist pump achievement area of having to do something else in the middle as well, and I can fully appreciate that. Kent, I've really enjoyed spending this last sort of hour, 45 minutes, however long it's been, chatting. I found it really interesting. Thank you very much for giving up your time.
It was fun.
Sharing this stuff with us. If people want to sort of maybe know more about you or what you do, do you have a blog? Are you on Twitter? Give us the URLs, give us the Twitter name or whatever else so that people can generally stalk you and make your life a misery.
Okay. On Twitter, my name is K Suther. It's KSUTHER. My website's also ksuther.com. It's kind of been kind of derelict since we've been spending all of this time on Flexibits, but I'm hoping that eventually I'll be able to get back to that. And if you want to check out Fantastic Hell, it's at flexibits.com.
Kent, that's been fantastic. We want to thank you guys in the chat room for your questions. It's always great to see you online with us, and I think the Convo chat room is working out, so that's uh, That's cool. It's definitely a lot better than where we were before. I just want to give a shout out for the MacTech conference 2011. MacTech has merged this year with NS Conference USA. It's going to be in Los Angeles, 2nd to 4th of November. So it's a 3-day conference. What's interesting about the MacTech conference is there's an IT track and a developer track, and there's some joint sessions. But it's really intriguing because often we go to a developer conference and it's great to hang out with developers and know, you know, and really sort of, you know, have some nitty gritty bar talk. But some interesting aspects about a conference where there's IT people as well is, you know, some of these guys are users, and so hanging out with users at a conference where they're learning as well, get their impression, you know, sort of, you know, what pain does this cause you installing the stuff on a network, learning all this stuff, you know, adds a real different dimension. So best thing to do is to go to MacTech.com/conference. There is an early bird pricing, which runs out fairly soon, but I can't tell you exactly when it is off the top of my head. I should really know that, shouldn't I? Speaker lists are now being published and session lists, so please do go check it out. I'm looking after the developer track there, so I'm going to be there and hope to catch up with a load of people. So go check that out at MacTech.com/conference, and if you like the look of it, which I'm sure you will, go and book. I'm just about to click the click here to register a thing and find out when the early bird runs out. The early bird runs out on the 31st of July, so you better get out there pretty darn quick. Save $500 on the early bird, I think it is. Okay, right. It's been great to have you all here. If you've been listening on the feeds, thanks for downloading us. My name is Scotty, MacDevNet on Twitter. You can check all our video resources out at iDeveloperLive.tv. John will be back next week. He's swanning around Europe at the moment. He's in Italy. But next week, for the first time ever, John will be in the iDeveloper Live studio. Well, I call it studio. It's a bit posh. He'll be in the same room as me in the UK. We're going to talk all about cappuccino. And that's not the drink. That's the web development technology. So until next time, you take care. Thank you.